From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Will the U.S. help Venezuela or hurt it? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. After months of deadly protest over living conditions and human rights abuses, President Nicolas Maduro is accused of running a phony election. Official results from Sunday's voting replaced the previous General Assembly with a new one subject to his total control. President Trump has increased individual sanctions against Maduro and other powerful figures, and there's talk of interfering with the vital oil economy. Would that fend off a potential dictatorship or give Maduro the scapegoat he needs, possibly leading to civil war? Later on today's Talking Point, small-town America prepares for this country's first coast-to-coast total eclipse in 100 years. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Norman. I'll need to back with To the Point. Venezuela is said to be on the verge of becoming a failed state, and President Nicolas Maduro has increased political instability by staging what's called a fraudulent parliamentary election. We heard about potential American sanctions. Will they make things better or worse? Today's Talking Point, not since 1918 has the continental United States been in the path of a total eclipse coast to coast, when the moon completely covers the light from the sun. We heard about the spectacle coming later this month and the impact on small towns when millions of viewers crowd in to see it. First, this news update. A week after January's inauguration, President Trump talked by phone to the leaders of Mexico and Australia. The Washington Post has obtained transcripts of those conversations kept by note takers, revealing what the Post calls jaw-dropping lines, very different from what was reported in official news releases. Colm Borchers is with the Post's blog called The Fix. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us. Tell us about some of these jaw-dropping lines. Let's start with the conversation he had with the president of Mexico, Mr. Peña Nieto.
Well, I think one of the striking things about the conversation with Enrique Peña Nieto, which came just a week after Inauguration Day, is the way that he basically conceded that he wasn't going to compel Mexico to pay for the border wall, at least not in the way that he talked about on the campaign trail. He sort of said, look, you know, we're both in kind of a political bind here, aren't we? Because I've told my supporters you're going to pay, and you keep telling your country that there's no way you're ever going to pay. So how are we going to resolve this? And they basically Trump tries to work out this kind of joint media strategy where he says, well, let's just tell people that we're working on it. And then he proposes a tariff, perhaps, on any Mexican goods coming into the United States, the premise being that perhaps you could raise enough revenue from those tariffs to offset the cost of the wall, and then he could sort of say in a roundabout way that Mexico really did foot the bill. And meanwhile, Peña Nieto can sort of spare him the dignity of, you know, actually writing a check.
How did Peña Nieto respond?
Well, he was noncommittal. He was not saying, yes, I'm on board with this message where we're working on it, because I think he realized that from a public relations standpoint in his own country, that would look like he was going soft on the president and that he was leaving the door open that perhaps Mexico would pay for the wall. And so what you saw in the follow-up, which played out in public, of course, was that, remember, the White House initially said that the two leaders had not talked about who was going to pay for the border wall. And then Peña Nieto told his press in Mexico, hold on, yes, we did talk about it, and I told them that Mexico is not going to pay. So that strategy, to the extent that Trump thought they had an agreement, did not last very long.
Release of the transcript has also caused the president some domestic headaches. Gene Shaheen, a Democratic senator from New Hampshire, is a little angry that he called New Hampshire a drug-infested den.
Yes, he did, and that was quite the passage. After calling New Hampshire drug-infested den, he then turns around to Peña Nieto and says, but, you know, you've got some problems, too. You've got some pretty tough hombres in your country, which was sort of a reminder of the bad hombres line that he had dropped in a debate back in October, for which he took a lot of criticism. So it was funny that he brought it up to the Mexican president. But, yes, he has offended some politicians in New Hampshire, for sure, by calling their state a drug-infested den. Of course, he's talking about a very real problem that plagues New Hampshire and a lot of other states, of course, which is the opioid epidemic, and Trump blames Mexico largely for it. He says that the drugs that are causing so many problems there and in other parts of the country are coming up from Mexico, and he wants Peña Nieto's help in stopping that.
And Peña Nieto says, a lot of the reason is that there's guns and money coming down from the United States, and it's your fault, not our fault.
Well, that's exactly right. That was his rejoinder right there and saying, look, this is partly on you guys as well, so let's not pin all of the blame here on Mexico. And again, then Peña Nieto sort of talks about, well, maybe there would be some kind of a virtual wall between our two countries, which he says would really be the best solution. And in his mind, a virtual wall would essentially be a good economic relationship. And if economic situation was good in both countries, perhaps you wouldn't have so much desperation for people to go across the border in the first place.
So something the president said so many times on the campaign trail, we are going to have a wall. It's going to be a big, thick wall with no doors in it. Or sometimes he's guessed he said there would be doors in it. And yet he was willing to offer compromises to the president of Mexico once again just a week after his inauguration. Quickly, let's get to Prime Minister Trumbull of Australia. He told him that he'd talk to Putin, Merkel, Abe of Japan, and the president of France today. This was the most unpleasant call.
Yeah, and this was in the context of Trump complaining about an agreement that he inherited from the Obama administration, which was the United States was going to take about 1,250 refugees who were being held at a detention center in Australia. And Trump was basically saying, how can I do this? You know, I ran as the guy who was going to tighten our borders, who was going to stop people from coming into the country. And now you expect me to honor this agreement? It's going to make me look terrible. In fact, I believe what he said was, I'm going to look like a dope. He was very concerned about his image in the context of this. And Turnbull was not backing down. He was basically saying, look, you need to show that you're a man of your word. This is maybe not an agreement that you struck, but your country did, and we expect you to honor it. It was not a very pleasant phone call. As our team reported in February, it ended quickly, and Trump said, this is the worst.
Transcripts revealed much more than we recognized earlier. Colin Borchers with The Washington Post and The Fix, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
In a moment, will the U.S. help Venezuela or hurt it? To the point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. Faced with a parliament controlled by his opposition, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro staged an election last Sunday, creating yet a new parliament. Voting was light, due in part to a boycott, but a new legislature was declared elected, subject to Maduro's control. Now there is credible evidence that the voting was rigged. One of those covering the story is Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez. We'll go to him in a moment. But first, let's go to Ryan Dubé with the The Wall Street Journal. He's currently in Lima, Peru, but he has recently been in Caracas. And Ryan, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Tell us a bit about the mood of the people in Venezuela at this point, particularly after this very controversial election. I understand a lot of people are fleeing for the borders.
Yeah, it's very difficult, very tense situation in Venezuela right now. What we've seen over the last few days since the election on Sunday has been two opposition, leading opposition politicians have been arrested in the middle of the night. There have been we've seen allegations of fraud, and those have been backed up by the company who ran the voting machines in Venezuela for the election, saying that the total tally of the votes has been tampered with. Just today as well, we've seen the Supreme Court imprison a local mayor in Venezuela, and has banned another politician from participating in elections for the next 15 years or so. So it is a very difficult situation right now, a very tense situation, and a lot of people are looking to tomorrow to see what happens when the new assembly, the Constituent Assembly, is expected to be installed tomorrow.
You mentioned the Supreme Court. Is it largely controlled by Maduro?
It is, yes. Largely, essentially, his allies make up the Supreme Court, correct.
Okay, so they were going to open the parliament, the new parliament, controversial new parliament, today. Now they've postponed it till tomorrow. Did they say why?
No, we don't know why. There's the Constituent Assembly. It was just they announced the new members yesterday, essentially. So it looks like today the opposition was planning to hold protests as well when the new assembly was to be inaugurated. But that could have been a reason why they decided to push it back an extra day or to give themselves a little bit more time. And the opposition has, in response, said that they will. Hold their march tomorrow rather than today as well.
On the street, before, during, and immediately after the election, was there a lot of skepticism as to whether this was, in fact, going to be free and fair? I understand the opposition tried to organize a boycott.
Yeah, absolutely. The opposition did. I mean, they did not participate in the election. They did boycott it. And when the layout of the new assembly was announced, essentially, It was seen and by international observers, by the opposition, by non-government organizations that follow Venezuela, it was seen as essentially, a way to stack. The government was going to win it one way or another, the way it was assembled. So it was, right from the beginning, it was seen as a way for the government to hold on to power and to maintain its influence. As it, loses support, it's President Maduro, the latest polls we've seen, is about 17% support right now.
You recently mentioned that two prominent opposition politicians were arrested in the middle of the night. They aren't the only ones behind bars, are they not?
That's correct. On the latest figures I've seen is July 29th, so just the day before the election, there was Foro Penal, which is a non-government organization in Venezuela, which has lawyers who represent many political prisoners. They said there was about 500 political prisoners in Venezuela right now. And on July 30th and July 31st, the day of the election, the day after, another 120 people were arrested and were being held.
Are people in Venezuela worried about what the United States might do about this?
There is, yes. So the concern for some, even on the opposition and just the regular folks as well, is that a full-scale embargo sanctions on the oil sector in Venezuela, what kind of impact that would have on the economy and on the humanitarian crisis that is already occurring in the country. About 95% of Venezuela's exports come from oil, so it would have a major impact on just regular people as well. That said, there are some people who see it as maybe one of the last options, really. But there are many others who would fear that being implemented.
And as to the humanitarian crisis and the standard of living there, what's the inflation rate?
So it's. This year, it's estimated to be between about 700% to 1,000% by the IMF. The black market rate for the bolivar, the currency, is at about 16,000 to one U.S. dollar right now. It has just been dropping very quickly in the last few days. Last week or so, before the election, it was at about 1 to 8,000. So. it is making it very difficult to, for people, almost impossible to buy a lot of essential goods there.
All right. Brian Dubé, once again, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, normally in Caracas, currently in Lima, Peru. Thanks so much for getting our program off to a great start.
Thank you.
Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez is an adjunct lecturer at the Kellogg School of Management. He's at Northwestern University. He's also a regular contributor to Foreign Policy magazine. Great to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
The United States now has increased sanctions against Maduro individually and his, and other powerful figures as well, including some here in the United States. What does that mean?
Well, that's a great question. The United States has been levying sanctions that are selective and targeted against individuals since the end of the Obama administration. There has been a pool. It started with the sort of enforcers, people who were directly in charge of, for example, intelligence agencies or prisons that were really cracking down on the opposition or on people who didn't agree with Maduro and his policies. That has then since spread to people whose, let's say, who the government or the U.S. government feels or believes, often credibly, have tampered with electoral democracy. Up until Maduro himself, after the Constituent Assembly vote took place, these are a very slow-working punishment. Most of these officials don't have a lot in the United States to begin with. They can move currency through allied countries such as China and Russia, but it does create a certain level of destabilization. It creates potential fissures between targeted and untargeted officials, and also attacks sort of the sense of impunity that for 15 years the members of this government in Venezuela have enjoyed. The general sanctions are a different matter, and there's a lot of speculation right now as to whether these targeted sanctions can move forward to general sanctions, in which you target an economy or a sector of the economy rather than targeting individuals. That's something that the United States does not normally do, and it would represent a large shift away from conventional foreign policy to get there. But the Trump administration has made some noises to this effect. The problem with doing that is that Venezuela, because of its arcane controlled currency mechanism, is able very easily to essentially pass on any damage done to the government's coffers to the people directly. Venezuela, after 100 years of being an oil economy or a petro economy, was one of the first, is very unable to produce even enough food to feed itself domestically, which means it's very, very dependent on a fragile lifeline of imports, which requires government financing to actually go through. So if, for example, PDVSA, the state oil company, were to be sanctioned, there's a good chance that the government would cut back injecting liquidity into that sector, and that's something that would take what is already a harrowing level of shortages on the ground in Venezuela and potentially tip that over into famine.
Let me turn to Laura Blewett, a Bloomberg reporter covering oil trading in the Americas. She's based in Houston. Good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
What would the consequences be, do you think? We heard Ryan Dubé, our first guest, mention the possibility of a total oil embargo by the United States. How devastating would that be, not just for Maduro and the enforcers and others high in the government who are thought to be repressors, but rather to the people on the street?
Yeah, well, as was mentioned earlier, big part of the economy in Venezuela is tied to oil production and refining, and the oil reserves in Venezuela is the largest home of oil reserves in the entire world. But that being said, oil production has been on the decline in recent years. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the state-owned oil company PDVSA hasn't been able to maintain their equipment. Furthermore, their refineries are only operating at about 43% right now. So we have already seen a decline, which goes in hand-in-hand with the economic declines that have been described. In terms of who they sell oil to, the U.S. is a gigantic customer of Venezuela. So they would have to first and foremost look for new customers. And so they would probably turn to China or Russia, who they do already have some partnerships with.
So oil is a fungible material. You can it looks the same whoever it is that ultimately buys it. Why can't they just do that and avoid the consequences of the U.S. cutting them off?
Well, a lot of it has to do with just the logistics of moving oil. So, for example, if they were to start sending more to China instead of the U.S., they would have to use larger tankers. They're so-called ultra-large tankers, right? And so those tankers aren't really capable of being loaded in Venezuela. They have limited capacity for that kind of thing. So a lot of it just comes down to logistics and equipment issues.
Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, you've written that if, in fact, that were to happen, and if the people of Venezuela felt the sting as a result, it would be something that would be a kind of gift to President Maduro. Why do you say that?
Absolutely. The ability of Venezuela, regardless of the fact that oil, as you say, is a fungible good, to readily replace the United States as a market is limited in several key ways. Russia has oil, doesn't need to import much more. China, the Venezuelan government owes China so much money, about, I believe, $62 billion right now, which it repays in oil, that selling oil and getting cash for it, which is what the government needs, is very difficult for it to do, which leaves India really as the only major market that both needs oil and has some refining capacities for Venezuelan crude, which tends to be very heavy. But the logistics of getting from Venezuela, which has no Pacific coast, to India are very daunting. And Venezuelan oil that already trades under market or under the Brent price would be harmed by the additional logistical considerations of trying to get there. For Maduro, that means that the loss of revenue would not only hit imports, as I mentioned previously, but also Venezuela's capacity to pay its other major creditor, which other than China, which is Wall Street. There's a tremendous amount of money owed in bonds, both by PDVSA, the state oil company, and the country itself, to Wall Street. And over the last 3 years since oil prices first fell at the end of 2015, or 2014, sorry, it has been struggling to try and keep that going. Venezuela is a country that if it defaults, the consequences for the population could be very drastic, not only because it would lose a lot of its international assets like CITGO, which would be damaging down the road, but also because of what I mentioned before in imports. So Maduro has been struggling to pay off these mounting debts as is, borrowing money from one group to pay off another in a very untenable fashion. But general sanctions would offer an excuse, an external excuse, to be able to say, well, this is terrible. Look at how much the people are suffering, but it wasn't my fault that this happened. It was our old enemy, the United States, whose imperialist meddling has been the cause of most of the problems Venezuela has had in the last 15 years of revolution, which has been the government's line all along. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that gives Maduro a lot more wiggle room and forces him to take a lot less of the blame for the crisis, which would be much worse.
Laura Blewett, to what extent, pardon me, to what extent are the big oil companies in the United States and elsewhere concerned about this? They're the ones that ultimately end up moving stuff around, I gather. And are they worried that if the United States were to take actions of the sort we're talking about, it would disrupt the world economy?
So far, we're not seeing the biggest refiners of Venezuelan oil putting up any red flags. So the top importers are CITGO, which is a subsidiary of PDVSA, Valero, and then Phillips 66, which was spun off from ConocoPhillips and Chevron. And they have other ways to get that kind of heavy oil. They can buy it from Saudi Arabia, for example. Mexico has some heavy sour crudes.
Okay.
They could also potentially supply. So Yeah, they have other alternatives.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break, as I indicated. On our talking point later, small town America prepares for this country's first coast-to-coast eclipse of the sun in 100 years. That's To the Point, of course. This is To the Point from PRI. We'll return with this conversation in just a minute.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Norman Olney back with To the Point, talking about Venezuela today, and principally we have talked so far about politics and oil. The president of the country, Nicolas Maduro, has caused to be created by an election that many people say is phony, a new constituent assembly, which is scheduled to open tomorrow and be completely under his control. In the meantime, opposition people have been arrested in the middle of the night in their homes and joined others who are already in prison, some 500 political prisoners in that country. We also heard that inflation now is at 700 to 1,000% in that country. Many goods are simply not available at all. Tamara Tarasiuk is a senior Americas researcher at Human Rights Watch. She is based in Buenos Aires. And thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you for the invitation.
Tell us about the condition of human rights in Venezuela and how much that exaggerates the problems that we're talking about.
Well, it's very difficult to choose from a very large menu of human rights problems in Venezuela today. We are seeing enormous levels of repression on the streets. Since early April, the people have taken to the streets. They're discontent with government policies and the abuses. And this has been met with brutal force. We've seen security forces shooting at point-blank range at demonstrators and bystanders. There have been, as you were saying, more than 120 people dead. Of those, the vast majority were killed by security agents or members of armed pro-government groups that operate with total impunity. But in addition to this repression on the streets, we are seeing an increased number of civilians prosecuted by military courts. More than 460 people have been prosecuted for crimes, including rebellion or treason, for the mere fact of participating in a protest. These are trials that are held in military courts or improvised courts inside military installations, usually in front of military guards, and with absolutely no due process. And also, the issue of the Constituent Assembly is very, very, very problematic. It's not just the fact that it's made up of government supporters. It's the powers, that the frighteningly vague powers that this assembly is going to have that would allow them, for example, to indefinitely suspend elections. That's a possibility. To get rid of the attorney general, who used to be a government loyalist and is now becoming more and more critical of the government, and even to get rid of the National Assembly, which is Venezuela's legislature. So it's not just a matter of whether there was a problem with the voting system on Sunday, which the problem in the bottom line is that that election never should have happened because the risks for democracy are huge.
You mentioned the attorney general. There was a report today that he has announced that he will investigate the election. Does that seem to be a real pledge that has force behind it or not?
Well, she has been very active in recent months. The attorney general used to be a government loyalist. She was behind the prosecution of political prisoners in the 2014 crackdown. But since late March, she has become a very critical voice, and she has played an important role exposing government abuses. There is absolutely no way that her investigations are going to have any success inside Venezuela today, because in Venezuela there is no independent judiciary. The judiciary reports to the executive branch, and there is no way it's going to have any effect legally inside Venezuela. However, she is sending a very important message to Venezuelans and to the people abroad that is generating a paper trail. when eventually judicial independence is restored in Venezuela, this is going to be very important.
How concerned is Human Rights Watch about the alternative actions that we heard earlier by the United States? One, the individual sanctions that have already been imposed and are being imposed, and two, the more general sanctions that would interrupt the oil economy.
Well, in terms of individualized sanctions or targeted sanctions, those could be very effective to dissuade government officials from violating basic rights in the future. The problem, as Daniel was saying, this is something that can't be seen as solely a U.S. Move. And in fact, that is changing in the region. Countries like Mexico or Colombia have also decided to impose targeted direct sanctions on specific individuals, like freezing their visas or their assets. And these measures that are directed at specific individuals who are implicated in grave human rights abuses and are experienced in other contexts have had a very positive impact. Sanctions that have a wider effect or wider reach and can affect the population are not so convenient. In addition to the anti-imperialist rhetoric that, you know, I agree with what was being said before, that this can just give Maduro the perfect excuse to blame someone else for policies that are exclusively his government's responsibility. The humanitarian crisis in Venezuela is very, very large. We have seen severe shortages of medicines, medical supplies, food, and this is having a huge impact on many Venezuelans' lives. They can't have access to inadequate nutrition. They can't get access to the most basic health care. Just, you know, in terms of official statistics, in the health minister published official statistics saying that in 2016, infant mortality rose 30%, maternal mortality rose 65%, and malaria, which is a disease that is eradicated elsewhere in the world, has increased by 76%. So you don't want... The situation is bad enough. You don't want to give Maduro the excuse to make it worse.
Tamara Tarasiuk, again with the senior Americas researcher at Human Rights Watch based in Buenos Aires. Juan S. Gonzalez is with us. He's associate vice president now with the Cohen Group, formerly deputy assistant secretary of state for Western Hemisphere in the Obama administration, special advisor to the vice president of the United States, former vice president Joe Biden. Juan S. Gonzalez, welcome to Europe.
Thanks for having me.
How long has this situation pertained, and did the Obama administration do enough to try to exert some sort of control over Maduro and ease the situation for the people who are obviously suffering to such a great degree?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. But this is something that has been several years in the making. I mean, in the course of a few years, the Venezuelan government has eliminated freedom of the press and assembly necessary for political discourse, has demonized and arrested political opponents, including Leopoldo López, which was mentioned earlier on your show, and has taken what should have been a great oil wealth, and today the reserves are all but gone, the grocery shelves are bare, and violence is certainly rampant. Under the Obama administration, we did two things. First is we lowered the decibel level on the debate with Venezuela because by fighting publicly with the government, we were eliminating any sort of space for political discourse in the country or for other countries in the region to take a leadership role.
And is there also that concern that the United States doesn't want Maduro to be able to point to it as the villain that's causing all the problems?
That's exactly right. It's dismissing this perception that the U.S. fosters hemispheric polarization. We, over the course of 8 years, essentially reached out to those countries in the region that maybe weren't the closest to the United States to try to find areas of cooperation, and that kind of diffused and led to the decline of this Bolivarian alliance for the Americas that was led by Hugo Chavez and then by Maduro. But the second thing that we did is actually try to encourage the Maduro government to have a real dialogue with the opposition. When I was working with Vice President Biden, we traveled to the Brazilian presidential inauguration on January 1st, 2015, and he actually walked up to Maduro and said three things that you can really do to turn the page and take put the course the country on the right course. Number one, release political prisoners. Number two, you have to have a real conversation with the opposition about the future of the country. And number three, there's some tough economic decisions that you must take place that must take place. And then at the same time, in parallel, there was an instruction given to the Department of Treasury and to DEA and others to really do all the work necessary to investigate corruption, investigate human rights abuses. And that's something that took place over the course of a few years and provided the stage for the Trump administration to level these individual sanctions, which is something that has to be applauded. The sectoral sanction question is a whole another one that could actually undermine a lot of the work that took place under the Obama administration.
So far, the Trump administration has, in fact, adopted what you said was set up by the Obama administration. That is the targeted sanctions against individuals. And there is talk about more general sanctions. How likely do you think those are to be imposed?
Well, so I know that the administration is, I think, taking great pains to make sure that the sanctions, such sectoral sanctions, wouldn't first hurt U.S. businesses, so there may be some sort of exception for Citgo, but also have the least impact on the Venezuelan people, which is going to be, I think, very difficult to do. It's important, I think, to clarify here that the sanctions would be not just stopping the import of heavy crude from Venezuela or the export of refined product, but it could be something where they could target the Venezuelan sovereign debt market by prohibiting U.S. persons from actually purchasing Venezuelan debt. And then, two, they could go after and stop any sort of investment that would go into or purchase of debt into PDVSA. So it wouldn't necessarily be stopping the flow of oil. And that would have varying degrees of impact on U.S. business. But the second and third order effects on the Venezuelan people will be significant. And as others on the show have mentioned, but second of all, it is something that could actually lead to a loss of what has been growing regional and global support to increase the pressure on Venezuela. 40 countries right now have not recognized the results of last Sunday's election. As somebody had mentioned, other countries have actually leveled sanctions. This is something where the U.S. can't actually do it alone, or it will actually feed the narrative that the U.S. imperialism is to blame for everything that's going on. Now, whether they actually move forward with this, there are a lot of things that could happen between now, the individual sanctions, and the sectoral sanctions that the administration can do to slowly increase the pressure. I don't think there's a consensus in the administration. Certainly, there's not a consensus on the Hill. Senate Democrats and Republicans, I think, are going back and forth on whether it's the smart thing to do and what the impact actually may be on the Venezuelan people. And I think the other question, and it's unclear because the administration has actually articulated a strategy on this, is the United States also preparing for what happens the day after they level such sectoral sanctions? Are they ready to come in with humanitarian assistance? Are they ready to actually come in and help the Colombians with the flow of migrants that would come across the border? Is there a full plan to essentially own the response to this? And that's unclear at this point.
Let me go back to Tamara Tarasyuk with Human Rights Watch. Would there, do you think, if such sanctions were imposed, be, as Mr. Gonzalez just suggested, a humanitarian crisis in the country and a flow of refugees into neighboring Colombia?
Well, they would definitely have an impact, but I would like to note that we are already seeing the flow of refugees into the region. Over the past couple of years, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have left the country. Some are fleeing political persecution. Others are fleeing the humanitarian crisis. I've interviewed people in different countries. Some left by plane. Some left, you know, on foot. Some took days-long bus rides. And people, I think the constant thing in all the interviews I did to these people is that they felt they had no choice and that they had to leave. And the other constant thing you see in those interviews is that they want to go back home. So these sanctions could multiply something that we are already seeing, which is a huge spike in the emigration of Venezuelans who are fleeing Venezuela's crisis.
Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez, back to you with the College School of Management at Northwestern, contributor to Foreign Policy magazine. The term possible civil war has been dropped from time to time in reports about Venezuela. How likely is that awful scenario?
So it's a good question. Unlike a lot of civil war scenarios, the opposition in Venezuela is not terribly well armed. That said, so having sort of internecine strife in which there's two sides that are fighting over the capital, as is sort of, you know, as took place in the United States, for example, is not all that likely. The Venezuelan government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on arming itself, mostly with arms that are designed for civilian control, APCs from China, tear gas from Brazil. And a lot of these weapons or a lot of these instruments are actually quite cutting edge, things that have never even been used in China where they were designed, but which may someday be. The actual risk happens more with the various, there was a reference earlier in the show to what are called colectivos, which are essentially militant leftist groups, many of which have been armed by the government. Then you have militias. And on top of that, you have another factor that we haven't brought up, which is very powerful and influential narco-trafficking and smuggling factions. So Venezuela is a tinderbox that's ready to explode, in as much as having all of these very heavily armed groups. And even though they have been broadly supportive of the government because the government has failed to crack down on their businesses, their respective businesses, or has cultivated their allegiance by arming them better, as things break down and the situation gets worse on the ground, a lot of the incentives for these groups start to become misaligned. And where we could see clashes would actually most likely stem from that. And that's something that's very dangerous, that the last time Venezuela, at least the urban areas of Venezuela, had large-scale violence was in 1989 during the riots that later became known as the Caracazo. And those riots took place at a time when the Venezuelan population was not particularly well-armed. You know, a lot of rifles, sticks, homemade handguns, you know, rocks, baseball bats. But even then, when things got out of hand, there were hundreds of deaths and then many millions of dollars worth of property damage. Today, when there's AK-47s and grenades, that could be much, much worse.
Juan Gonzalez, we're essentially out of time. So very quickly, if you can, it would appear that situation in Venezuela is going to get worse rather than better, and that that will happen very quickly. Is there any potential quick fix to this that the United States could be involved in, or are we going to have to grit our teeth and stick it out?
Well, I think the Venezuelan government is at a crossroads. They can continue entrenchment as the country flies off the precipice, or call for elections to rescue the country's sovereignty. And I think that is a route that only the diplomats can win. The sanctions won't actually achieve that. And so U.S. diplomacy is moving forward. It's something that's going on back channel. That needs to succeed. Otherwise, I think the worst case scenario may actually come true.
Juan Gonzalez, again, formerly with the Obama administration and the office of Vice President Joe Biden. Thanks to you. Thanks to Mara Tarachiuk with Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Buenos Aires. Laura Blewett covers oil trading for Bloomberg. She's based in Houston. Thanks to you as well. Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, Foreign Policy Magazine. And our earlier guest, Ryan Dubé with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much, all of you, for helping us get a better idea of what's going on in Venezuela. We'll hear what it will take to really experience this month's total eclipse of the sun on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Ollie back with today's Talking Point. Here's the astrophysicist and TV personality Neil deGrasse Tyson explaining why a solar eclipse is something not just rare, but worth checking out.
Try to get to it. It's a stunning spectacle because the moon is 1/400th the size of the sun, and it is 400 times closer. And those two facts got to cancel out, and the sun and the moon in the sky are about the same size. And so when you have a total solar eclipse, the moon exactly covers the sun. It becomes as dark as night in the middle of the day. And animals behave all weirdly and things, including and especially humans.
Later this month, the U.S. will see its first coast-to-coast solar eclipse since 1918. The path of totality will be 60 or 70 miles wide and stretch from Oregon to South Carolina. Here's biologist and science writer Diane Kelly. Great to have you on our program.
Hey, glad to be here.
This must be one of the most dramatic things that any human being could experience. And I have seen Annie Dillard and others write about one of the aspects of it, which is that you get a sense of how fast the moon is moving because of the way the shadow comes. It just takes 2 minutes.
Well, the totality only takes 2 minutes. The eclipse itself covers more time than that, about a period of about 3 hours start to finish.
Okay.
You just can't see most of it. So even in the path of totality, most of the eclipse will be a partial eclipse. And the sun is so bright that when until you get really close to totality, you can't really tell that it's happening without either projecting it onto a screen with a pinhole camera or by using one of those pairs of solar filter glasses.
So it's really worth getting into the center of that strip 60 miles wide.
If you want to see it, that's where you're going to have to be.
Are you going?
Oh, indeed. My family's been making plans for about 2 years now.
Okay, we'll come back to you in a moment. But first, there is this fact. The path of totality clearly will attract not just Diane Kelly, but a lot of other people as well, millions perhaps, to small-town America. Lisa Vantimo is a plan facilitator for Madras. That is a town in eastern Oregon. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
I think it's Vantimo, and excuse me for pronouncing it incorrectly. But tell me, you've been working on this for a long time to come. That's a town of 6,000 people. How many visitors do you expect for the total eclipse?
We're expecting about 100,000 people, and that could increase depending on what the weather turns out to be on the west side of the Cascade Mountain Range.
Could also depend on how many programs like this, I suppose, talk it up.
That's true, too, yeah.
So that's a lot of people, 100,000 people in a town of 6,000, and presumably they won't all come with sleeping bags. Where are they going to sleep? How are they going to stay? How are they going to eat?
So, excellent question. You know, we've had a lot of our farmers. We're a high agricultural community out here. And a couple of years ago, when we were deemed one of the premier locations for the eclipse and started talking with our community, a lot of our farmers and agricultural landowners started saying, you know, it might be a good idea if I create a campground out here. And thus they did. And so we've got at least 35-plus campgrounds on farmland that have been permitted and insured and porta-potties and showers and vendors put on them. And we've taught farmers how to be website owners so they could pre-sell campsites online. And we've taught them how to market them. And we've been helping them be successful. And the bookings are coming in. There's still space available, but there's quite a few that have already been booked. So it's been a fascinating transition to watch these farmers turn into campground hosts and become website specialists and all of that. It's been very interesting. But so we have a lot of campers coming in.
Is there any way to control the price of a sleeping bag to somebody whose car broke down on the way in from Utah and who gets there late?
Well, I don't know about controlling that. We did sit down with all of the campground hosts, I'll call them, early on and said, you know, Madras has always been a place where we are kind and welcoming to people. And let's keep that experience going throughout this solar eclipse. And let's agree now on what a tent space looks like in size and what it should cost and what an RV space should, the size should be and what it should cost. And let's agree amongst ourselves now. And let's not gouge anybody. And I am pleased to say that I have seen that carry through for the last 2 years. And I expect it to continue through for the next, 20 days or something left. And so I think we have a good experience so far.
Well, we can all hope that you're right. I want to go back to Diane Kelly again, science writer and a biologist. You say you're going to get there, and you've been making plans for a long, long time. Why? What's so important about this from a scientific point of view?
Well, I'm not an astronomer. From a scientific point of view, as far as my science is concerned, it actually does not relate in the slightest. But from a person who loves science, I am very excited about the prospect of seeing this amazing astronomical phenomena for the first time in my life, which may be depending on whether, you know, could be the last time in my life that I get to see it.
Well, you'd say that you're not interested in it because it's not your kind of science, and yet there's a sort of science, it seems to me, just in studying the way that people respond to this extraordinary experience. And, of course, they have been responding to it since they have been human beings. Literature is full of it, and song is full of it, and sometimes it's pretty scary. Sometimes it's the voice of God or the gesture of God.
Well, I suppose that if you don't know what's happening and the sun, the point of totality occurs, as we said before, over a very short period of time, just over 2 minutes, and that the fact that the sun is so bright that you can't really detect it easily until you get really close to the point at which the sky goes dark, that could have been very frightening for people before we understood what the phenomena was. As it happens, though, there is still a lot of really really interesting science that astronomers are going to be collecting data for during an eclipse, and that they try to collect data for every time they have the opportunity to go to an eclipse. Stuff about data about the solar corona, which is easiest to see during the eclipse, and I do also note that there is a citizen science program that called with iNaturalists that people can join and can watch animals during the eclipse and record what animals are doing, since there's been for a very long time anecdotal data about animals behaving oddly during total solar eclipses.
Okay. I, once again, it seems to me that experiencing the speed of the moon shadow moving across the Earth, something that no human being has ever seen except under these circumstances, must be an extraordinary experience itself. Very quickly, Lisa Vattimo in Madras, Oregon, what are you going to do when the eclipse actually occurs?
Well, I haven't quite decided yet because I have a lot of great offers. With Lowell Observatory being here and the Science Channel streaming live from our high school, that's an exciting opportunity. And a big festival with NASA out at our fairgrounds, that's another exciting opportunity.
Okay.
And then, so I just haven't made up my mind yet. There's so many great festivals and events going on in town that I have family.
Thanks to you both. That's all the time we have. We'll be right back tomorrow on To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.